This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Really, when we see that weather out there, it's bigger and badder and more impactful because of what we have done to it, that we've warmed it up.
We will terminate the Green News scam immediately.
Summer is 2 months early in Central Asia. The first 11 days in Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan were all above 30 degrees C or 86 Fahrenheit, a little bit early. But just listen to the harsh heat wave hitting India's capital, Delhi, and its 33 million people.
India's Delhi has fast-forwarded straight into peak summer this year. What's usually reserved for the sweltering months of May and early June has already gripped the capital in early April. With dry winds, rising humidity, and a full-blown heat wave, the temperatures crossing the 40 degrees Celsius mark, residents of Delhi are now facing a brutal preview of summer far earlier than expected. Delhi is officially in meltdown mode, quite literally. On the 7th of April, Delhi recorded its first official heat wave of the season, with the mercury peaking at a sizzling 40.2 degrees Celsius. This was the highest maximum temperature so far this year, surpassing the previous 39 degrees Celsius recorded just days ago on the 3rd of April.
So the summer season is here, and India's national capital, Delhi, is experiencing some pretty scorching temperatures. The temperatures are expected to soar to over 42 degrees Celsius by the 10th of April. The Indian Meteorological Department has forecast a very severe heat wave across the northern part of India in the coming days, which will drive up the mercury levels across the region. Now, the capital is expected to witness mainly clear skies with humidity levels peaking at about 45%. A hotter day lies ahead with minimum and maximum temperatures forecast at 23 degrees Celsius and 40 degrees Celsius.
Still don't care? How about the 100 degree day in Phoenix already, a month earlier than usual? That's a spring heat wave over the whole U.S. Southwest.
We start today with an early spring heat wave in the southwestern United States. We're only 8 days into spring, but it's starting to feel more like summer for some cities that are reaching record temperatures for this time of year. Phoenix, Arizona came just shy of hitting the 100 degree mark, reaching 99 this week. If they had reached the forecasted triple digit temperature, it would have been their earliest 100 degree day on record based on National Weather Service data. Normally, the city averages its first 100-degree day on May 11th. In California, cities like Bakersfield and Sacramento City broke high-temperature records that were set in 1997, reaching 91 and 88 degrees, respectively. The unusual warmth is also reaching the Pacific Northwest, where record-high temperatures in Portland and Seattle are creating a rare thunderstorm threat that hasn't been seen this early in the year for at least three decades.
No matter what weather you experience lately, according to Copernicus in Europe and the U.S. NOAA, the world had the warmest January ever recorded. It was 1.75 degrees C above the pre-industrial level. 18 of the last 19 months were over the alleged 1.5 degree safety line for climate change. We get the hottest months ever recorded on this planet, despite the La Niña conditions which normally cool things down. This is over-the-limit superheat, unless you are this guy.
The day I take office, we will terminate the Green News scam immediately. I will stop energy price hikes.
Donald Trump got elected promising cheap gas at the pumps. He would turn the USA into an energy superpower. Off with the protections and national parks. Drill by the beaches, frack by the schools, do whatever you want. Because they are firing the regulators and the scientists who measure this stuff and the prosecutors who enforce anything related to pollution, the protection of nature, or climate change. The artificial intelligence bros are scanning all government data to find anything related to climate change. They want to delete all that and fire the scientists who produce it. Or just fire scientists generally. Or get rid of the universities. Who needs those eggheads? We need funeral music. The end of climate science in America may be nigh. That is not a fringe worry anymore. It is happening in real time. Paul Voosen holds a master's degree in science journalism from Columbia. On April 11th, he filed this story at science.org, the publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The title is, Trump Seeks to End Climate Research at Premier U.S. Climate Agency. White House aims to end NOAA's research office. NASA also targeted. I'm just going to pass this on, reading from Voosen's article. President Donald Trump's administration is seeking to end nearly all of the climate research conducted by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, one of the country's premier climate science agencies, according to an internal budget document seen by Science. The document indicates the White House is ready to ask Congress to eliminate NOAA's climate research centers and cut hundreds of federal and academic climate scientists who track and study human-driven global warming. The administration is also preparing to ask for deep cuts to NASA's science programs, according to media reports today. The administration's plan would eliminate all funding for climate, weather, and ocean laboratories and cooperative institutes, says the document, which reflects discussions between NOAA and the White House Office of Management and Budget about the agency's 2026 budget request. Currently, NOAA operates 10 research labs around the country. They include influential ocean research centers in Florida and Washington State, 5 atmospheric science labs in Boulder, Colorado and Maryland, and a severe storm lab in Oklahoma. It also operates the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory in New Jersey, the birthplace of weather and climate modeling, as well as a lab in Michigan devoted to the Great Lakes. The agency further funds cooperative institutes, which support a large collection of academic scientists who work closely with the NOAA labs. The proposal would cut NOAA's Competitive Climate Research Grants Program, which awards roughly $70 million a year to academic scientists. It would end support for collecting regional climate data and information, often used by farmers and other industries, and it would terminate the agency's National Oceanographic Partnership Program and College and Aquaculture Sea Grant programs, which support a host of research efforts. NOAA officials still have time to persuade OMB to alter the request, but NOAA sources said it is unlikely to substantially change. But this proposal is only the first stage of the budget process. Congress will have the final word in setting NOAA's spending. At NASA, science programs also face severe cuts, according to details first reported by Ars Technica. The White House is considering requesting a nearly 50% cut to NASA's science office, down to an overall budget of $3.9 billion. According to Ars Technica, the plans call for a two-thirds cut to astrophysics, down to $487 million, a greater than two-thirds cut to heliophysics, down to $455 million, a greater than 50% cut to earth science, down to $1 billion, and a 30% cut to planetary science, down to $1.9 billion. Such NASA cuts would require ending the operations of a huge host of Earth science satellites. They could also result in the closure of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, which has thousands of employees and is one of the agency's premier centers for Earth science research. The cuts would also end plans for Mars sample return, the Da Vinci mission to Venus, and the Nancy Grace Roman Space Satellite Telescope, which is almost fully assembled. That is an end from a quote from Paul Voosen at science.org, with work from Eric Berger's report April 11th at arstechnica.com on the NASA cuts. Find links to all that in my show blog. You should read it. Close the Goddard Space Flight Center? Forget new Earth science satellites? Fire the biggest and possibly best climate science teams in the world?
What's that you see?
Nothing. Killing me.
Big storms, rooftops fly.
seen coming, dancing in their graves, machines still humming. Keyword search, delete, delete, billionaire score, mission complete.
In the year 410, the Christian father St. Augustine kept a diary of his times. The German tribes known as the Vandals were storming across North Africa. They were at the gates of his ancient city of Carthage. Then he received impossible news. Rome itself was sacked. Augustine foresaw the ancient institutions of learning, government, and the arts crumbling away, leading to a long period now called the Dark Ages. Are we there yet? I don't think so. But we can smell burning institutions in America, once a light of democracy for the world. Big-name universities like Harvard and Princeton and Columbia are being defunded and told what to teach. Until now, the brightest students, scientists, and scholars came to those universities from around the world to learn and spread their brilliance. They have all been sent home, abruptly, with no warning. They find an email announcing an immediate cut to funding and told to self-deport. One scientist I follow on Blue Sky was followed in February, rehired a week ago, then fired again. Others have watched 5 or 10 years of research suddenly wiped out, along with their paychecks that paid the mortgage and their families. Big black holes of data are opening up in America, formerly the biggest bank of weather data and climate science anywhere. In recent weeks on this show, I asked guests from Europe and Australia whether climate science can be maintained and go forward without NASA or NOAA. In today's feature interview with the grand old man of Canadian weather and climate, I ask again, twice, because nobody, none of our guests, could take that seriously. After working this beat for decades, I see NASA and NOAA science in almost everything, and the new deniers plan to kill that off.
This Congress should enact a moratorium on the construction of any new coal-fired power plant.
On April 8th, Trump stands in front of some burly men who might be coal miners, and they look pretty strange, out of place in the Oval Office. He signed an executive order to boost the American coal industry. Trump wants a rash of new coal plants to fuel data farms for artificial intelligence. He's dumping any incentives to buy electric cars, removing any legislation requiring phasing out gas vehicles. The electric revolution is over, along with all that other green crap, he says. The new Environmental Destruction Agency fires any investigators and dump the pollution rules, so just go for it. The new Orwellian great leader says, there is no climate change. Hey, that was all a scam. Wow, that's such a relief. Don't believe your lying eyes. Never mind the heat and all those bodies overseas. But disasters come again and again. David Jellies writes about climate economic disaster warnings for the New York Times on April 10th. He notes a Morgan Stanley report expects the world to heat by 3 degrees Celsius. A UN GAP report also found the world likely to warm to 3.1 degrees C over pre-industrial, by the end of this century. That means flooding of cities like Rio, Shanghai, and Miami, just to name a few. A February report from First Street found the U.S. would lose $1.47 trillion in lost real estate values by 2055, just 30 years from now. 80,000 homes would be lost to floods in the next 15 years in New York City, according to two reporters in the Times. Gunther Thallinger is a member of the supervisory board of a company called Allianz SE. It's a giant Swiss insurer. He told the Times, quote, "The math breaks down. The premiums required exceed what people or companies can pay. This is already happening. Entire regions are becoming uninsurable." But the risks extend well beyond the insurance business, Thallinger said. "This is not a one-off market adjustment," he wrote in his post. "This is a systematic risk that threatens the very foundation of the financial sector. If insurance is no longer available, other financial services become unavailable too. A house that cannot be insured cannot be mortgaged. No bank will insure loans for an uninsurable property. Credit markets freeze. This is a climate-induced credit crunch." End quote from David Jellies in the New York Times, April 10th. You think the stock market is melting down now? Wait until the real world melts too, and you won't have to wait long. So let's get to our feature guest with Canada's take.
Radio EcoShock.
The world's second largest country gets a lot of weather. For more than 40 years, Canadians heard about it from David Phillips. He was a senior climatologist for Environment Canada and spokesperson for the Meteorological Service of Canada. David is also a weather historian, and he's an author appearing on radio, television, and magazines. He's won many awards, including the Order of Canada. From Barrie, Ontario, David Phillips, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, Alex, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to chatting with you about a very important topic that is, hey, maybe not so much in the news these days, but we seem to be focused more on economic issues. But boy, climate change and environmental change is still one of the most important environmental issues that humankind has ever faced, and we have a long ways to go to try to solve that.
Yes, we can worry about tariffs in the stock market, but we're still getting hit by ice storms and crazy heat in different places of the world. So, in recent months, I have seen dangerous weather roll across North America. It's blizzards and ice storms and tornadoes and flooding. Seems like every night on TV. You are a weather historian. You've published an annual summary since 1996. Is this just another spring, or are we entering a period of chaotic weather events?
Yeah, it's a tough question, you know, because what we don't necessarily keep track of, because every storm, every event is quite different and different character and different personality, and so, you know, there are hurricanes and there are hurricanes and there are snowstorms, and they could be hitting a rural area and causing problems for them, but hitting Toronto or Edmonton, hey, that could create more chaos for people. So it's I always think it's hard to compare one year with the next. It's almost a collection of extremes and various conditions, and you just sort of say, well, gee, you know, since a particular year for me, for example, it all began in 2021 when I think Canadians began to see that climate change was a threat to themselves, to their backyard, to their front yard, to their neighborhoods. Prior to that, Alex, it was all about climate change was an Arctic thing. It was about, you know, melting ice and the permafrost, and it was about ice calving off ice caps into the ocean. It was about can't build ice roads. It's about skinny polar bears. And so people would say, well, I've seen examples of it, and I've read about it and seen documentaries on it, but boy, in 2021, for the vast majority of millions of Canadians in the South, it sort of hit home that this wasn't something that my gosh, occurs on the other side of the world, either in the Arctic or in Bangladesh or Botswana or Bolivia. My gosh, it's occurring in Burlington and Brandon and Burnaby. I mean, we're seeing this in our own settlements. And I think that had an enormous effect on Canadians. And we saw it as extremes of weather, quite variable. It was storms we had never seen before, really, and impactful. And so many elements of that seemed to change. And I think that this is when Canadians became aware of the threat. You know, before that, it was sort of, well, you know, I'm concerned about climate change, but probably more interested in my barbecue on the weekend than I am about climate change. I mean, I'll be safely dead before that begins to bite deep and hard. But as something that was futuristic was now seen as more present. And I think that really shook Canadians up. And I see, certainly, from surveys done of Canadians, that's when they really began to think that, hey, this climate change was a real thing. It was not futuristic. It was happening now. It wasn't not just for my grandchildren. It was happening to certainly today. And so I think there was a big change for that. Now, this year, I mean, I look back over the last few months, and we certainly came out of an El Nino from last year, and we're into a La Nina for this winter, and that has produced some differences. This El Nino, the warm pool of water in the tropical Pacific, and it was sort of dead in the water, and then, boy, it took a long while for the La Nina, the cold phase, to come in, but it eventually sort of did. So I think that was a situation we saw last winter. Was almost, I've often said, well, we've canceled a few summers in Canada, but never winters. Well, winter of last year, we had the warmest winter in Canada, warmest worldwide, certainly the warmest winter in Canada. It felt like everybody said, well, gee, it was more like a Vancouver winter across the country, with snowfall totals down, more fog, more rain than snow, and again, warmer. And so this year was more kind of, it certainly was a lot colder, particularly in the last half of winter, more snowy. So I think we've seen these variations, this wildness, this wackiness with the weather. But I don't think it's necessarily all of a sudden changed this year. I just think that we get periods where we see a lot of active weather, and other times where things seem to be a bit quiet. So it's hard to say that this is a fluctuation or a trend. It's just the way that the weather works, and it can be wild at one time and less so at the other. But when you plot it and look at it and graph it and look at it statistically, there's clearly evidence that we're seeing more of these things. That yes, you might not see it one year, you see it another year, but when you average it over a period, look at that trend, squint your eyes and tilt your head, you see clearly a trend that's upward. Not only warmer conditions, clearly the jury's concluded on that, but whether there's wild weather, I think there's certainly a lot of evidence to suggest that is the case, but not necessarily to the way you could predict that this year is going to be worse than last year.
Environment Canada also warned that extra climate heat might hide in warmer night temperatures. Has that played out?
Well, in a way it has. I think really that is really what the real sort of evidence of climate change, global warming, is in terms of temperatures. And we've seen certainly the temperatures have gone up, although what is sort of interesting is that the real, you know, and I can give you all kinds of examples of why this is not the case. I'm going to misspeak now when I said, well, gee, we haven't seen the warm temperatures exceedingly warm now as we did in the past. And my gosh, in 2021, we broke an all-time record for Canada. The previous record was 45 degrees back in 1937. And in 2021, in the last couple of days of June into July, we saw a little place called Lytton, British Columbia, which had broke Canadian records for 3 days in a row, and the fourth day it burned down at least a good chunk of the town, and we saw temperatures that rocketed up there to 49.6 degrees, average rounded up to 50 degrees. I mean, that is incredible for the second coldest country in the world. I mean, this is warmer than any place in the United States outside of the desert Southwest, warmer than Las Vegas and Phoenix, warmer than any temperature in centuries in Europe, and warmer than any temperature ever seen in South America. I mean, here, we are a cold country. We're known as the Great White North, a land of ice and snow, and yet we can brag about the fact that we've recorded a temperature that many parts of the world have never seen. But I think it's the nighttime temperatures that have me worried more than anything. Because, Alex, when you look at nighttime temperatures and you look at the impact of that, and that is through deaths, mortality and morbidity statistics, that clearly it's the nighttime temperatures. Now, the nighttime temperature may not be as warm as the daytime temperature, but, you know, there are not as many cooling centers open at night. Ventilation drops, so the air circulation is less. And you can't go to theaters and movies and at 3 in the morning. And so what we find with heat waves around the world, whether it be in Europe or in Asia or even in our own country, in Canada, I think about 2021 or that heat dome over British Columbia and Alberta, I think the most shocking statistic of all was not that we broke a new record for Canada, but we saw the deaths from that. 600 people in British Columbia died during that 10 days of scorching temperatures, and 80 people in Alberta. I mean, you know, we normally set up a royal commission when 3 people die from a heat wave, and I think people are still numbed and clearly pained by that. And a lot of the people were poorer people, were ill anyways, and had difficult time and were living alone, and so it really did show how vulnerable we are to warmer temperatures. And fortunately, we've seen some near warmer, there's warm temperatures since then, but we have not seen the deaths because we learned from that.
And I'm hearing more about weather whiplash. For example, a rainy period encourages plant growth, and that is followed by a sudden drought, and then high temperatures and possibly wildfires. I remember Canada's premier fire scientist, Michael Flanagan, told us that the thin soils in the northern boreal forest only take about 3 days of dry heat to create fire-ready conditions. Is whiplash real? Are you seeing it, David Phillips?
Well, you know, it certainly was a word I wouldn't have used, say, 10 years ago. But I think it sort of became in vogue about, I think, 2017. I began to see reference to it, and you know, it made sense to me. I mean, I can give you examples of weather whiplash. I think there are actually a few more now than that. Maybe people are more in tune to the word and then are more looking at it. But you've given some really good examples. One that, and I think in some way, Alex, it's I would define it or separate it out between weather whiplash and sort of climate whiplash. Now, and it's not referring to, you know, a cold front, warm front moving in or a sea breeze and a land breeze where you can get temperatures from one day to the next. These are generally kind of changes that you have in almost in a weather state from over a larger region, maybe part of a continent, and so some examples. Let me share some examples. I think this maybe to your listeners will kind of emphasize what is really meant by weather whiplash. I remember in Manitoba, southern Manitoba, in 2023, that March and April were the two coldest March and Aprils they've ever had. In March, there wasn't a temperature in Winnipeg, for example, that got above freezing. And that is the first time in 125 years that's occurred. So that was cold March and April. Then we came to May-June, and we had the warmest May-June on record. Never have it been a 2 months of May-June together in a century and a quarter that have ever been warmer. So think about that. You went from slush to sweat on May 1st. I said that spring lasted 6 days that particular year. So you went from one state of brutally cold to one of incredibly warm. And so, I mean, that's a really good example of what we talk about in terms of weather whiplash. And I remember, certainly I've mentioned the 2021 episode in British Columbia, and I remember that particular period there where very hot, very dry, with forest fires, and it changed the landscape of British Columbia. The soil, the vegetation was burnt, the ground was blackened, and then when the rains came in the wet season, Well, that rain, that water just went where it wanted to go. It didn't have, it couldn't be absorbed or percolate. And so you had, at the end of the year, massive floods that caused billions of dollars of infrastructure loss. So in a way, that's kind of weather whiplash, where you had dry, dry, dry with forest fires that came right on and burnt the surface, but yet the fires and the drought had nothing to do with the rains falling, the exceptional rains, almost monsoonal rains, falling in the fall, September, October, November of that year, and yet the ground was conditioned not to accept those rains, and you ended up with something like that. You know, there's so many other examples. One that I often speak to when I speak to groups and I talk about, and again, in Manitoba, an agricultural example, you had in 2020, 2021, and 2022, Alec, there were 3 years of growing seasons where there was exactly normal precipitation. You average all those 3 years together, and farmers could say, oh my gosh, this is the best growing season ever. We had exactly the amount of rain that we needed. Not. What you got to produce a three-year average right on normal was two of the driest years followed by the wettest. You can't harvest with those kinds of extremes. And so that, in a way, is kind of what I'd call climate whiplash, where you're going from one state of just dry and dry to another state of wet. I mean, you talk to a farmer and they'll say, well, I remember back in 1956, we had the wettest growing season on record. Oh, and the driest, I think that was in 2021. But this is back to back to back. And so I think we're seeing more of that. One other example, an urban example, is the skating on the Rideau Canal in Ottawa, the largest, I think the longest skating rink, outdoor skating rink in the world. And 2 years, for 2 years, in 2023, 2024, there was virtually no skating. You count the number of skating days on your one hand and your fingers. This year, 2025, they had one of the best ever. So a kind of, we see almost as if we're seeing more and more of this. There's hundreds of examples in every part of the world of this kind of weather whiplash, this fact that you go from one state to another, you can't forecast it, and yet it's really impactful because it's really, you just can't, you know, we always think, well, just we, you know, we plan based on what we've had, you know. Well, no, I mean, you're going to have something different, and it really causes enormous impacts for people. And a lot of people are relating it to climate change. We're seeing a little bit more of it. I think where it is kind of climate change is that we're seeing that climate change affects, okay, temperatures, precipitation, that. But what it also affects is the atmospheric circulation. We're seeing the jet stream, which is the very important aspect of meteorology, where the cold air to the north, warm air to the south, and a lot of storms hook a ride on the jet stream. So you follow the jet stream, and you kind of know where the weather is. Well, instead of having, like, zonal kind of jet streams or bungee cord-looking jet streams, they are doing more dipping and diving, more like a skipping rope. And so we're seeing these ridges that develop strong and intense and stay put. And that's why we're seeing that heat waves last weeks, not days. And then you're seeing the troughs in that same kind of circulation that are digging in and just bringing periods of rain and stormy weather. And so I think the fact that we're seeing the weather in Canada, for example, has slowed down. It used to take a storm maybe 3 days to go from the west to the east. Now it takes maybe, you know, 4 days or 4.5 days. So the weather has more time to spread its misery. It rains harder and longer, and therefore we're seeing more of the impact. So all affected because of the changes in general circulation brought on by the fact that the world seems to be warmer for sure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is David Phillips. He's been the voice of Canadian weather for as long as I've been alive, almost. So look, about 10 years ago, I never heard the term atmospheric river in a nightly newscast or read it in the newspapers. Now atmospheric rivers are taking extraordinary heat right up into Greenland and Antarctica. Do you see this as a growing phenomenon, or are we just becoming more aware of things that have been going on for a long time?
Yeah, that's such a good question, Alex. And, you know, I think there's certain terms in meteorology that are sexy because, you know, people have changed the name of it. I mean, it could be the media. Media is like the polar vortex. My gosh, the polar vortex has been around for centuries. Even El Niño, La Niña. I mean, gosh, it's been around since 1600 when Peruvian fishermen said, oh my gosh, the warmer waters in the Pacific, that means lousy fishing. Fishing are lower, at depths of water where you can't get at them. And so, you know, we use these terms, atmospheric rivers, my gosh, you think it's in a new thing that's attacking the Pacific coast, whether it be Los Angeles or Vancouver, from storms from Hawaii. Well, that circulation has always been there. Imagine a person said, well, you know, it's almost as much water in the atmosphere as you're seeing in the Amazon River or the St. Lawrence or the Mackenzie. And so in a way, it's kind of like an atmospheric river. And so we see about, my gosh, on average in British Columbia on the west coast, maybe 25, 30 atmospheric rivers a year. And some are stronger than others. They sometimes want to give them names like atmospheric river 1, 2, 3, 4, like we name hurricanes and tornadoes. I think that sometimes it's just an imaginativeness of meteorologists working the night shift when they come up with these terms. And polar vortex, I mean, used to call it the Arctic pipeline. And so I wouldn't say that all of a sudden we've never seen them before. There's more attention raised to them. The public, instead of just saying cold air from the north, they want to know, is it a polar vortex? So I think it's just kind of a little bit of imagination, but and you know, when you look at some of these things, they do have a more of an occurrence more often sometimes than others. But it's like another one. Let me throw at you, flash drought. I've heard of flash floods, but recently I came across some reference to flash drought, and when I read about it, it made total sense. I mean, it's not sort of a conventional kind of a drought. That, you know, you see it, you sort of see it coming, that you worry about, is this growing season going to be bad like the last two because of drought? Oh my gosh, yes, there's no rain, we're into a drought. And all of a sudden you become something that's 2 or 3 years long, becomes a decade long, like we've seen in California. And then all of a sudden, I mean, talk about weather whiplash, a drought, and ended with torrential rains that went from fires, houses in Los Angeles burning down, to then sliding off the slope because of landslides and mudslides because of too much to water. So a flash drought is kind of interesting in the sense you almost are in it and you're not sure it is a drought. Like, and typically occurs in the hot time of the year, July and August. You've had maybe some precipitation. You've then really filled the soil moisture back up to the levels you want. Last year was a good year because you had a good amount of rain. But then all of a sudden, you get to a situation where, oh my gosh, the temperature is really warmed up. It's sucking all that moisture out of the ground. The evaporation is taking place. The transpiration is taking place. And all of a sudden, you see the plants wilting and you're into a drought situation before you knew it, and you can't do anything about it. So that word flash drought is becoming now. Flash droughts, only about 5 or 10% of the flash droughts lead to what we call conventional drought. It's an episode that occurs. It causes problems for farmers and water managers and forest firefighters, but it's just an example of the fact that, hey, when we look at these things, we want to give better definitions and better examples of them, and so that's why we sometimes use these words to help us understand them and distinguish them from other similar situations.
I've been tracking climate media for about 35 years, and I remember when meteorologists and their official associations were reluctant to discuss climate change at all. Some TV weather people, particularly in the United States, hardly ever mentioned it. Do you see a kind of evolution of weather science now as it gets closer to climate science and vice versa?
Well, I really do. You know, I mean, scientists are always reluctant to get involved in the political or the side of things. They feel that their job is to look at the science, to better understand the science, and provide good numbers, good evidence for politicians or economists or people who are who are in the position to do something about it. I always say that, you know, climate change science is easy. Deciding what to do about it is much more challenging. But I think that really meteorologists, on-air meteorologists, weather broadcasters, were always a little bit reluctant to go that point, because they had sort of, see, they know the difference between weather and climate. It's like a farmer. You know, I speak to a lot of farmers. They don't always believe what I say about climate change. I think the younger ones do, the ones that have gotten to some science and that. But they've seen so much weather in their lifetime that it's hard to convince them that this is different than what it was in other years. And yet I always learn from them that they're growing crops their parents would only dream of, which I said, well, there's evidence that you're seeing a change of climate. And they're also seeing more extremes that beat them up in storms that occur or heavier amounts of rain that lead to flooding and situations like that. So I tell them, well, that what they're seeing is they're living the climate change. They're living the predictions of the past, and that really is climate change, and it's why it's different than when you were just starting out in that area. But certainly I think the media, meteorologists or weather broadcasters have been reluctant. They seem to be coming on more and more now. They recognize, and why that is, I think, Alec, is because the public has accepted it. I mean, we've looked at polling, and we've found that 70% of Canadians believe that the climate has changed and that human beings have had something to do with it. That's a remarkable change from what it was just a decade or so ago. And not only that the vast majority of Canadians, again, 65-70% of Canadians believe that weather is more extreme now because of climate change. And I've always felt that when you look out the window, you can't see climate, you can see weather. But really, when we see that weather out there, it's bigger and badder and more impactful because of what we have done to it, that we've warmed it up. And when you warm up the atmosphere, every degree of warming says that the atmosphere can hold 7-12% more moisture. So that rainstorm that you get in Montreal is 30 years ago is going to be, you know, anywhere from, you know, 25-40% more, have more moisture available to rain on you. And so I think that Canadians, weather broadcasters, are seeing that more and more. But to think, though, Alec, and not to raise a political issue, to think that, you know, I get kids who write to me and want to know, how do we become climatologists? They used to be, wanted to be meteorologists, forecasters, storm chasers. Now they say, what kind of education do you need to be a climatologist? And to think in the United States, if you're a climatologist, you could be fired. And I think this just saddens me greatly. Great work that people have done who are dedicated. They're not trying to push their thoughts on it. They just want the truth, and they work on science to deliver that. And to think that their value is not appreciated anymore. In fact, it's almost as if they're shunted because of the valuable work that they're doing, I think is an incredibly unfortunate situation.
Yeah, weather forecasting depends a lot on American satellites and government data. Does Canada have enough equipment to accurately forecast the weather without American sources?
Well, I think one of the great stories of humanity is the fact the sharing of meteorological data from countries around the world. Countries could be at war with each other, but they're still trading sharing their weather information because of the good work of the World Meteorological Organization, which is a UN agency. And so I think people recognize the weather doesn't stop at the border, and you need storms that are occurring or events that are occurring in the other side of the world can affect the weather in your place. So your forecasts are going to be bigger, and they're going to be better, more accurate, more timely, more credible if you've got this incredible pool of data from around the world, from meteorological balloons, from satellites, from radar, and yes, it's sharing that information is important. The United States are very important, and they've had quite a great service to the world in providing that information free of charge, available to those who want it. And I think that I worry sometimes whether that standard will be lessened in the years to come. I hope not, because, say, I mean, something could be happening in the Amazon rainforest that could affect storms in Atlantic Canada. And so we need to know that information and share it. And one of the great, I think, success stories of science and really of civilization has been the fact that we better observe the world now. I think certainly computers have helped and radar and satellites, but the fact that we observe planet Earth, the oceans can't burp without us knowing about it now. And I think that has made people around the world safer and better off. I think I can remember, Alex, that back in 1971-72, there was a terrible storm that occurred in Bangladesh, a tropical storm, killed over 300,000 people. And I just how terrible that was to read that. Now, if 100 people die from a storm, it's so much worse. But we now know because of meteorology, because of better emergency measures, the value of life that people have, that the world is better off now than it ever has been. And there are fewer people dying from weather now than there was 100 years ago. And I think that is a great accomplishment and something that we should be proud of. But that is certainly comes from the fact that we're observing the world better and we're sharing that information for everybody, no matter what their political state is.
But just to press the point, could Canada accurately forecast the weather if American sources are not available to us for any reason?
Well, I mean, I think we can for sure. I mean, I think it's, we were forecasting the weather not too long ago by just wetting our finger and throwing up chalk in the air. But no, I mean, we certainly depend upon all of the radar and the satellites and the supercomputers and the data. Certainly, the more data we have, the better off our forecast will be. It's a slow process. You know, people say to me, well, gee, you can put a person on the moon. Why can't you forecast tomorrow's precipitation better? Well, I mean, people's demands and expectations for weather are much higher now than they were in the past. I mean, my gosh, people said to me when I began my career over, you know, 50 years ago, they'd say, well, it's going to rain tomorrow in Toronto. And now they want to know, it's going to rain in North York after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, exactly when it's going to end and how much rain and how hard is it going to be. I mean, our expectations from weather people have increased dramatically, and yet we've improved. But, you know, the improvement is very slow. We often say that our performance increases on an average of 1 day every 10 years. So our 5-day forecast 20 years ago is as accurate as our 7-day forecast is today. And so that's with all the bells and whistles that we have. The supercomputer, the largest computer in Canada, is for the Weather Service. And so it really takes a lot of skill and men and women and machinery and eyes in the sky to do that. I mean, I just, it's hard for me to express what the difference would be in our accuracy of our forecast if we didn't have the satellites and the radar. I mean, we have European satellites that we could use, the Japanese, and have the American satellite. That would be an incredible loss, but it would mean that we would just have to maybe do it a little differently in some ways. The error rate might be a little higher, but hey, Canadians would certainly get their forecast every day that they depend upon it now. They would still have that in the future if something to the United States went to drastic means. And I certainly think there's no talk of that. I mean, it's a matter of, it's just unthinkable that would happen, because it would affect the accuracy of Americans, and that I think they would be not right to do.
Well, these are the times when the unthinkable happens tomorrow.
Well, that's true. Unfortunately, we've seen that. Who would have thought we would have had what we see today just a short, 6 months ago? So, yeah, you're right. I mean, we have to prepare for sometimes what we don't want to, but certainly you can't put all of your eggs in the one basket. You've got to have different ways. That's why we have different models, different Canadian models. We have European models, and we issue them, and we have to say something, and some are more skillful than others. And the other thing is, you always learn from it. That's the beauty of meteorology, and is that you're always learning from your past experience, and hopefully that makes you a better forecaster in the years to come.
From Ontario, Canada, we've been speaking with the voice of Canadian Weather and Environment, David Phillips. Find links to the stories we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David, it's been great to talk in person, and thank you for spending time with us.
Well, Alex, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it very much, and it was a lot of fun. I wasn't sure what would happen, but thank you very much for taking me and allowing me to share some of my thoughts with your great listeners.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
January 2017. Haven't I seen this movie before?
Human society in times of climate change is like a sinking boat taking on water. The crowds will rush from one side to the other. As we know, sometimes that causes the ship to tip, throwing everyone into the sea. Right now in America and Australia, and perhaps soon in the UK or Europe, the captains try to say, there is no problem. Donald Trump denies that climate change is happening. It's a hoax, he says, as he appoints fossil fuel people to regulate the environment, science, and energy. Of course, the physics of the melting ice world, the heating oceans and rising seas, don't care what he thinks. According to a Florida risk analysis agency, by the year 2045, Trump's so-called winter White House, called Mar-a-Lago, will be underwater 210 days a year. Maybe humans will make it a special dive site where you can visit and remember the American president who made the dumbest mistake in the world. That drowned resort will be a gold-plated monument to climate change denial. He'll be dead, of course, and so will millions of others, but that temple of excess under the sea will be a signal of the legacy of Donald Trump. At dozens of military bases, the American forces face the same problems of rising seas and more intense storm surges. Later in this program, we'll hear from Erica Spanger Siegfried at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She led a comprehensive report into the coming challenges to military bases as climate change unfolds. But first, we'll talk to a medical genius who can explain how and why denial is so easy to trigger in human beings. I'm Alex Smith. Here's this week's serving of Need to Know Information from Radio EcoShock. After decades of great science showing how climate change operates, we get an incoming American administration composed of climate science deniers. How is that possible? A listener suggested I contact Ajit Varkey about his book Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind. So now we're in for a treat. We'll spend a little time with an awe-inspiring professor of medicine and pioneer researcher from the University of California in San Diego. Following his beginning in India, Ajit Varkey has led American explorations into cellular and molecular medicine. His multifaceted mind also ventures into the origins of humans and, as it turns out, a critical mechanism of human consciousness. Understand the role of denial, says Varkey, and you understand a lot about your own life and the civilization around us. Ajit Varkey, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Your meeting with Danny Brower and this book on denial shows to me that advances can be almost accidental or serendipitous at least. Tell us about Danny Brower.
Yeah, that's really a case of serendipity in science. I, as you mentioned, mostly study cellular and molecular medicine and cellular and molecular differences between humans and other species. But once in a while, I venture into sort of less familiar territory, such as psychology and so on. And when you do that, you're guaranteed somebody would come and give them your opinion, their opinion. You know, everybody has an opinion about the human mind. And so I sat down for lunch at the University of Arizona in 2005 after giving a lecture. And this bearded man sat next to me and said, "You're all asking the wrong question." And then I realized he was the chair of cell biology, Danny Brower, and he gave me this fascinating idea. I'd never thought about it before. And I suggested to Danny that he should write this up, and we sat there for an hour and a half after everybody's gone talking about it. And But then I never heard from him again. And then a year later, I tried to contact him, still got no response. And I finally looked him up on the internet and found his obituary. And so not knowing what to do, since he had not published his basic idea, I wrote a letter to the journal Nature along with my own embellishments of his idea and extensions. And that was published in 2009, I believe. And shortly thereafter, I was contacted by his widow, who said, Sharon Brough, who said, thank you so much. Can you please finish Danny's book? And so I ended up with Danny's incomplete manuscript and done something I'd never done before, write a book with a man I'd met only for an hour and a half and was no longer with us.
That is amazing. Well, let's get to the essential theory that you and Danny propose. Why do we humans need denial as a function of our intelligence?
So let's step back and acknowledge, I think you will, everybody will, it's not just climate change. We deny anything we don't like. You know, I study the mechanism by which red meat increases the risk of cancer and heart attacks, and yet 80% of the people in my lab eat red meat. And we could go on and on, right, whether it be exercise, national debt, different levels of denial, but we're all in some form of denial or the other. So it's a very peculiar human characteristic, and it's never really been explained. There are many discussions about this, you know, different names for it, cognitive dissonance, other kinds of words used in different books written about this general phenomenon. But why would we end up with something like that? And that was the question that Danny approached in a new way. And the basic question he asked was something that I'd never thought about. You know, people like me have been looking for a long time to say, what made us human? What was that cognitive leap, or what were the series of genetic and biological changes that made it possible for us to, say, you know, run a radio station or whatever? And when you think about that, you assume that it was just natural selection gradually, you know, selecting for an improved mind. And Danny said, you should not be asking that question. We've got birds, we've got elephants, we've got dolphins, we've got whales, we've got chimpanzees. I just described 200 million years or more of evolution where we had many, many smart, warm-blooded, social, complex, intelligent creatures. So he said, you should not be asking what made us human. You should be asking what stopped everybody else. Why aren't we competing with a human-like elephant or a human-like dolphin or a human-like crow? Why is just one of us was one species taking over the planet? So that was the sort of counterintuitive idea he put in my head, which I'd never heard before.
And what is that barrier? I mean, what happened? It sounds from my reading of your book that a double leap happened.
Right. So after thinking about it further and I realized that I coined a term in the book, a psychological evolutionary barrier. So we've all heard of physiological evolutionary barriers. For example, going from water to land, that's not easy and wasn't done many times. And you can't just, you know, walk out onto land and start living. You've got to have many things work just right. So it's a barrier. And there have been many such barriers in evolution that have been surpassed by complex processes of evolution. But when you have a barrier, many things have to go just right at the right time in order to break the barrier, as opposed to just gradual, you know, improvement by natural selection. So this psychological evolutionary barrier that Danny was positing has to do with something we must begin with, self-awareness. Now, all of the species I just mentioned, crows, corvid birds, elephants, dolphins, etc., can recognize themselves in a mirror. This kind of study has been done to varying extents, most convincingly in chimpanzees. They know who they are, just as we know who we are. So they would be like a 2 to 3 year old child who can recognize himself or herself in the mirror. So that's pretty close to where we are, after all. And more recently, it's been shown that they even begin to understand the minds of others. But this is the critical step.
Genius medical researcher Ajit Varkey on his book Denial, Self-Deception, False Beliefs, and the Origins of the Human Mind. The full interview was broadcast on January 11, 2017. Find a link in my show blog. Thank you for listening.